Hey, folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and today we're honoring Women's History Month. And among the wonderful women on our staff at Risk is none other than our story producer and story studio instructor, Cindy Freeman. So I thought I would take my maleness out of the picture here and hand the reins over to Cindy for this episode. Take it away, Cindy.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm Cindy Freeman, and this is This is Chaka Khan behind me, and of course, as I said, I am Cindy, and I'm really honored to be hosting this episode. I work on the show, occasionally tell stories on the show as well. I am a story coach and a casting person. Actually, if you are one of the people who have pitched the show and you're like, who is reading these pitches, it is most likely me. So today we are presenting three amazing stories from incredible women to honor Women's History Month. Now, I did some research into this and discovered that the first National Women's Day was celebrated right here in New York City in 1909 by a socialist group. Yay, socialists. But it took them a number of years to actually decide to set on a date. I don't know why they chose March 8th, but it happens to be my husband's birthday, and I do think he is the gift to all women. So, you know, there you go. Somewhere around 1978, however, there was this group in Santa Clara, and they decided that, you know, maybe women should be celebrated more than one day out of the year. And so they were like, March, it's an entire month. And that is when it started. And this is what I have learned from Wikipedia about this grand holiday that we are celebrating here at Risk with these wonderful stories. So, in a while, we're going to hear from Robin Gelfenbein and Jess Lombardo. But we are going to start with a story from Jean Labeck. Now, I know and I've always respected Jean, but this story, oh man, it truly makes me love her. This story first appeared in Risk in April 2014 on an episode called Freedom. So here is Jean Labeck with a story we call Butterfly Kiss.
It's September 30th, 1966, and I am marrying Fred Miller. We are standing under the chuppah. The ceremony is long, and it's in Yiddish. We don't understand one word of it. But we are waiting for the words, and finally we hear them. The rabbi says, I now pronounce you man and wife. You can kiss Mrs. Miller. I close my eyes. This is the kiss I've been waiting for, that every bride waits for. And I turn to kiss Fred, and he turns and kisses his mother. It was a sign. And now it's 4 years later, 1970. I'm 22 years old. I have a beautiful little girl, Amy, who's 2 years old. And I have a husband who acts like he's 2 years old. Fred just takes naps all day and goes out on play dates with his friends at night. So we are living on food stamps. And I am trapped by the fact that we have no money. Amy thinks that turning on the lights means you light candles. So on the morning that I hear the news that the city university system was starting a program called Open Admissions, with just a high school degree, you could go back to college, any college, I dressed Amy, got on the 41 bus down Flatbush Avenue, and enrolled in Brooklyn College as an education major, along with hundreds of other women. We went back to school, and our children came with us because we had no childcare. So we would be sitting in classes and women would be nursing their babies and taking notes at the same time. And there would be cranky toddlers, you know, climbing around chairs. I had Amy in this kind of baby backpack and I would just kind of wiggle all day and keep feeding her pretzels, crackers, anything to keep her quiet so I could focus on the lecture. So we formed this committee, and we went to the administration, and we said, look, we need a room in a building on campus, and the administration reluctantly agreed. So we started a daycare center. We brought in cots and cribs and toys and stories, and we made up schedules, and in between classes, we would run to the center and give a hug, wipe a tear, make lunch. And other women began to come to the center as well. It became like a place for women to gather. But by mid-year, administration wanted the room back. And so early on a January morning, it was really cold, 10 of us stuffed pillows under our clothing. And with signs, we went around chanting, we've been fucked by the administration. We've been fucked by the administration. And by noon, there were 100 of us, all these women stuffing pillows up their clothing. We've been fucked by the administration. They called the police, and the police began chanting at us, you know, go home, you know, feed your husbands, take care of your kids. And we would chant, we've been fucked by the administration. And students began leaving classes. It got really big. It was electric. And we got our room. My friend Sally organized a woman's consciousness-raising group, and every Wednesday, we would sit in her living room on this burnt orange shag rug. We all looked exactly the same. We were wearing overalls, beige work boots, a white T-shirt. We actually looked like we were part of some kind of prison gang, you know, chain gang, you know. But we would sit cross-legged, and we would share a joint, and we would cry, we would laugh, we confessed our sins, and we gave advice. Sometimes terrible advice. A woman would share, oh my God, my husband, he wants me out of these overalls and into a dress and makeup and look a little sexy. And we'd be like, leave him. And, you know, or it would be like, you know, he doesn't do the dishes. And, you know, I try talking to him. He doesn't understand me. Leave him. There should have been like some kind of warning label. You know, if you enter this group with a man, you will leave without that man unless he's your son. So the book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, had just come out, and we would read it and pore over it like it was the American sex novel. We just had so much fun. We would say words like, ovaries, fallopian tubes, how's your uterus? It was at one of these meetings that I met Mona, and she had hair to her shoulders, red hair and big gray-green eyes. I liked her right away. She had style because her overalls were embroidered with beautiful little flowers, very intricate beautiful little flowers hanging on these green zigzag vines. And she smoked Benson and Hedges. She had this way of kind of tapping, and she would take a drag, and she would exhale, and she would talk while she exhaled. So the smoke just kind of went around her words. I thought she was so sexy. But after 6 months in Sally's women's group, my marriage to Fred ended, and I think he was relieved. You know, I promised him he could have as many play dates with Amy as he wanted. And Mona's marriage also ended, and we became friends. Her daughter Ingrid was exactly the same age as my daughter Amy, and we lived very close to each other. So we began to rely on each other. If she couldn't pick up Ingrid, I did. And if I couldn't pick up Amy, she did. And we began to shop together and cook together, do laundry together. A natural rhythm kind of formed. And when I wasn't with her, there was always something I felt I had to tell her. But we had this major disagreement, major, and that was what we called our vaginas. Because I called my vagina a vagina, and Amy called her vagina a vagina, but Mona called her vagina a snatch, and Ingrid called her vagina a snatch, which drove me crazy. So we had to change the names of the vaginas, so we decided on pussy. But now the vaginas had two names because the girls couldn't make the transition. So Amy would say, my vagina pussy. And Ingrid would say, you know, my vagina snatch, like, you know, John Doe or Jean Levesque. And one evening, we got babysitters, and we went to see the movie Cabaret. And we were sitting in the car right outside my apartment building after the movie. And, you know, we were sitting, and we were singing, "Money makes the world go around, the world go around," when Mona just looked at me and she said, "Boy, you know, I really feel like kissing you." So I said, "So kiss me." And she kissed me, and oh my God, it was like butterflies were in my mouth, and it was like trumpets, ta-da, and sunsets, and this was the kiss I was waiting for. And I ran out of the car, and I ran into my apartment, and I just paced the kitchen floor saying, call me, please call me. And she did call me, and I grabbed the phone, and she's going, "Jean," and I'm going, "Mona," and she's laughing, and I'm laughing, and I slid down the kitchen wall all the way to the hard linoleum, laughing, holding the phone, my knees to my chin, gripping the phone and laughing, and so we became lovers. But we really didn't know what to do without a penis. And so, if you can imagine, like, tiny little kittens kind of rolling and petting and, you know, doing, and you say, that, you know, like all these little things. But that was kind of like what we were doing. And then, but one night, Mona lit candles, and she put on Carole King. And to this song, "You've Got a Friend," she found her way past my pussy snatch vagina to this whole other place. And I came, like really came, for the very first time in my entire life. Yes! Yes! Woo! Well, before going to sleep that night, she said, "And you know, sweetie, you could do this to yourself anytime you want." Well, I woke up that morning with this unbelievable, you know, joy, this new sense of power. And I worked 6 blocks away in a daycare center. We had a 45-minute lunch. And so, the moment it was lunchtime, I ran those 6 blocks and I prayed that elevator didn't get stuck on some godforsaken floor. And I masturbated. I masturbated quickly and slowly, lying on my bed with my clothes on, with my clothes off, at my kitchen table, in front of a mirror. But then, one day, just as I was about to make my escape, I am surrounded by 4 of my coworkers, and they're like, "No, no, no, you are not going anywhere." And they kind of ushered me into this tiny little classroom, and there were like little chairs in a semicircle. It was like a celebrity intervention, and we just all sat down, and Pauline, who was the spokeswoman, said, "Where are you going every day? You leave here as soon as it's lunchtime, and you come back looking all weird, and, you know, you don't eat lunch with us anymore. You miss Neil's birthday. What the hell are you doing?" And I looked at them all, and I said, well, I'm masturbating. And Pauline said, "You're masturbating. You're masturbating every day?" And I was like, "Yes, I am masturbating every day." And she's like, "You're masturbating every day." And I'm like, "Every day." And she's like, "Holy shit." And I said, "But listen, you know, don't, you know, tomorrow I'm eating lunch with you. Don't worry. Tomorrow I'm eating lunch with you." And she said, "No, no, 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 no. Tomorrow I'm going home and I'm masturbating." And then that evening when I told Mona that I think, you know, I might have said too much, that I think everybody might now know I masturbate everybody in the daycare center, she was like, "Ho, ho, ho. Now, every time you go to the bathroom and you spend a little extra time in there, they're going to be like, ho, ho, we know what you're doing in there." Mona and I loved each other, and we never questioned it. We took it like a gift. We healed each other's wounds, and we helped each other go forward. We gave each other courage. I wouldn't have gotten through school without Mona. And it broke my heart saying goodbye to her, but she wanted to go to Maine and live on the land and grow vegetables and poop in an outhouse and build a cabin and no running water, and that wasn't what I wanted to do. And so we said goodbye. And for the first 2 years, we wrote letters. We tried to stay in contact. We visited each other. She came to New York. I went to Maine. But life has a way, and we just kind of melted away from each other. And 40 years passed. and we never said one word. But I found her on Facebook, and we made kind of a telephone date, and I was so nervous calling her. And then I did call her, and the phone rang, and then she picked up the phone, and she was like, Jean, and I was like, Mona, and we laughed, and we laughed, and in that second, I was once more that very young woman who slid down my kitchen wall holding a butterfly kiss, and she was wearing embroidered overalls. Thank you.
We'll be right back. We're back.
All right. Hey guys, I'm Jess.
Hi, Jess. Hey.
Thank you, I needed that. All right, so I moved to this wonderful city of DC back in 1999, or what I like to call DC's pre-Whole Foods era. I had just finished college and I didn't have a job, I didn't have a place to live, I didn't have much more than the pack on my back when I came out here. I just knew, though, that the black cat was here in DC, and I was ready for a punk rock adventure. See, I'm what you call a Midwesterner. I grew up in this cozy small town. My mom was my religion teacher. My dad, my high school principal. Needless to say, I didn't see a lot of action in my early years. And after 16 years of Catholic school education, straight A's, and living my life by the book, I just wanted the opportunity to make some poor life decisions. I wanted to experience something real, like real world real. And as a former overachiever, I took this open attitude very seriously. For my first few months, I lived in a youth hostel and scrubbed toilets for my bed. After that, I kept seeing this ad in the city paper by this guy named Moon Dancer who wanted to start a commune out in Kensington. And I thought, hey, why not? So I moved out there. And in order to grow the commune, we'd invite people over, cook these giant meals with them, and then at the end of the dinner, Moon Dancer, who also looked like Santa Claus, would stroke his long white beard and ask, so how was the dinner? And everyone would be like, it was great, it was really good. And then Moon Dancer would say, and all of this came from the dumpster. So basically, whoever was down with eating food out of the trash is who we lived with. It was one pretty interesting group. But eventually, I did make it down to 14th and U, moving into this group house right around the corner from the black cat. And for this young, wide-eyed Midwesterner, that kind of felt like the big leagues. I mean, there I was every night, hanging out in the red room, sandwiched between these hot men in their skinny black jeans and their flannel shirts and their big beards. My roommates were the most fun and awesome punk rock musicians. Ian Mackay from Fugazi would just show up in my living room sometimes. I know, I wasn't that cool to know who he was the first time. But it was like show and tell every day. And I wanted to touch and feel everything. I finally felt like the free spirit I had always wanted to be. I moved from one adventure to the next. I made life happen. Literally. No, literally, I fucking made life happen. And at 24, found myself accidentally pregnant with a guy who lived in the basement's baby. So maybe a little too free-spirited. But let me tell you, folks, that guy in the basement looked a hell of a lot like Jesus. And I took that as a sign, perhaps a catastrophic one. But if I had really moved here for a real-world experience, this was a pretty good plot twist. So my sweet, naive, 24-year-old self decided, I'm having a baby. And for the next 9 months, I got my shit together. I said goodbye to my punk rock friends and got an apartment in Mount Pleasant. My dad gave me a 1987 Buick. Dude, I didn't even know how to drive. And I worked my ass off to get a raise to a generous 30K. And every Saturday, my best friend was there for me. She'd pick me up on the back of her moped, and we'd whirl around the city, going yard sailing and thrift shopping, and getting everything that baby would need. And at 7 months pregnant, I must have looked like a Buddha on the back of that bike, but I felt like a badass. I mean, I had never been the cool kid. I was the bright, shiny, happy kid. But at 24, single and preggers, I wasn't so sure I still had that shine. However, on the back of that bike, I felt transformed. From that shiny kid to one kick-ass mom. Now, there were a few things that I did skip out on, like Lamaze class. I mean, those classes are kind of expensive. And this was 2002, the year Rachel had Ross's baby on Friends. So I watched a whole season of Friends. And when Rachel finally pushed out little Emma, I was full term and ready to do the same. So D-Day comes, and I waddle into Washington Hospital Center. I'm glad you like it there. I distinctly remember my ride up that elevator, my contractions rising with each floor. Like floor one, hey, I'm the cute pregnant lady. Floor two, contraction hits. Floor three, that poor gentleman next to me, I just grabbed onto his arm and started clawing in. Floor four, I rivaled Medusa. And as those elevator doors opened, and I walk towards the front admission desk, I can only imagine the hot mess I must have looked like. But those nurses didn't even flinch. And then one finally says, honey, this is your first child, right? Oh, you have hours of this. Wait a minute. Where's the part where I just stroll the hospital floors waiting for my baby to come? I had seen that on Friends. Here I was in full-term labor. My contractions were less than 60 seconds apart. And these nurses are telling me I have hours to go? And with those words, I realize I have no fucking clue what I'm doing. So they move me to my bed, and finally, a voice of reason enters. Ma'am, would you like an epidural? Now, every woman goes through a certain conversation in their head at this point, like, epidural, dear Lord, yes, no, what will my friends think? But then I realize, I don't even have other mom friends to brag about this with, so I say, hell yes, bring on those drugs. And I honestly think it was the drugs that I needed, because within 5 minutes, and two pushes, Nika Suzanne came into this world, and she was perfect. And I was her mom. Folks, free spirit or not, making the decision to have Nika is the bravest thing I have ever done. And her lying in my arms made me realize there was nothing I wanted more than to be her mom. That was a high. So they give us about a half an hour together, and then they move Nika downstairs to be washed and clothed, and I'm being moved downstairs as well. I start to feel this pain in my lower abdomen, but the nurses assure me it's perfectly normal. They give me some Advil, and they move me downstairs. But that pain just kept growing. And it grew angrier by the minute. Now, I tried to stay calm, but I had just pushed the equivalent of a watermelon out of my vagina. And I was kind of sure, Lamaze class or not, that that was supposed to be the climax. So I tell my nurse, something's wrong. But she just looks at my chart and she says, honey, you just had an epidural. It's wearing off and you're starting to feel your body again. So with each plea for help, that nurse just placated me with more drugs. Vicodin, Tylenol 3, Percocet. I should have been high as a kite, but that pain was traumatizing. And over the next couple of hours, I just grew more and more silent as the pain reached every part of my body. I have spent years trying to forget that sensation. But if I'm trying to convey it to you now, it sort of felt like someone taking the end of a broom and shoving it down my bowels over and over again. And the only person who could help me didn't believe me. What I should have done was tell that nurse that she was fucking out of her mind. But after too many years of Catholic school education, I had learned not to question things. So I just lay there, trying to get through it, telling myself, it's okay, you're gonna do this. And I remember my arm just instinctively starting to go up and down and up and down, just trying to give myself something to focus on, to follow my breath. And then my breath starts turning into these moans. And I'm moaning and moving and moaning and moving. And I don't even recognize the sounds coming out of me. My body is just trying to protect me, trying to get through it. And I do this until I can't take it any longer. And I pull myself up and I drop my legs over the side of the bed. And I just knew something has to give. And as I stepped down onto the hospital floor, buckets of blood just start gushing between my legs, which is just an absurd amount. And I know if I would have been watching the scene, I would have been freaking out. But I go into survival mode and I crawl through that blood to the bathroom, smearing the walls as I hovered over the toilet for more to spill out. And I remember the feel of those cold white tiles as I leaned my head against them, just thinking, this has got to end. But it didn't. Blood just kept spilling out of me. And I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't know how to fix this. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I just wanted back to my daughter. And so I decide to try to get back to my bed. And I get down on all fours, and I start crawling there. But as I go to hoist myself into the bed, just lifting my head is too much. I have the strength of a Gumby doll. And with that lift up, I fall backwards, slamming my head against the wall and passing out in my own pool of blood. I don't even know how long I was left there. What I woke up to was that nurse's scream as she ran out of my room, and then a doctor rushing in who immediately determines that I'm hemorrhaging, but then just barks. This woman is bleeding to death. Get her to surgery now. I was covered with my own blood. The floor was covered with my blood. The walls were covered with my blood. But never once had I thought that I could be dying. I had just become a mom. I was Nika's mom. And I don't know if you get a choice when you stand on that ledge between life and death, but I knew I wasn't ready to let go. I wasn't ready to let her go. And so as they roll me down to surgery, I just keep thinking, don't pass out, don't fall asleep. Think of Nika. Think of her round face and those hazel eyes. Think of the mound of dark, dark hair. Think of her tiny hands and those teeny tiny fingernails. Don't fall asleep. Don't leave her. And it was hours of surgery and 2 blood transfusions till I woke up again. And though much more feeble than before, I was back. And after a whole night away from Nika, they bring her in and they lay her on my chest. And that little girl instinctively reached out her hand and grabbed tight to my pinky. And I look at her and I whisper, "I will go to hell and back for you, kiddo. I love you so much." And that's how our life started out together. Now, I want you guys to know that I truly loved my early experiences in DC. They helped mold me into the fun and vibrant person that I am today. But it really is Nika who gave me my roots to flourish into the person I was always meant to be. See, I realized life gets real when it's not just about moving from one adventure to the next. It's about finding the one you're willing to own, to really fight for. And I am grateful every day to get to own this one. Thank you.
This is Risk, and I'm Cindy Freeman, and that is Ghost Script behind me with their fine rendition of Itsy Bitsy Spider. Not spider. All right. Who we have just heard from is Jess Lombardo.
So much blood.
It's like The Shining, except for there's a happy baby at the end. Man, I hope that nurse has like this reoccurring dream where she goes in the room and Jess is spelling out Redrum in her own blood on the wall. Before that, we heard Butterfly Kiss from Jean LeBeck. And I gotta say, man, the 1970s were a different time. I wonder if I could talk to HR about creating masturbation breaks here for the team at... Well, actually, HR department here is just Kevin and JC. I'm pretty sure they'd just be like, yeah, woo, do it! We're living the 70s here, and it's amazing. So... anyway, this next story is by one of my favorite women, both on and off stage. She's in New York, so I run into her quite a bit. This story first aired on Risk in July of 2013 in an episode that we entitled Hurt. Here is Robin Gelfenbein with a story we call Vargas.
So I couldn't wait to get to college. I was so excited because I wanted to study broadcast journalism at the same school. BJ Majors. I wanted to study broadcast journalism at the same school where Bob Costas and Dick Clark went, the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. Not because I wanted to be the next Katie Couric. I wanted to do funny stuff. You know, like I wanted to interview Ricky Schroeder at the mall or do like trapeze or be the wacky weather girl. I dream big. And everything was going great. I had the best roommate, Mindy Cohen. Not to be confused with the Mindy Cohen from The Facts of Life, although that would have been awesome. But this Mindy and I loved all the same things, like air-popped popcorn, musicals, and Balky from Perfect Strangers. And then all of a sudden, I started to hear like the strangest noise. And it was kind of like this hiss, and it would build. And I heard it every time I came in and out of my dorm. And I lived in a high-rise building, so I couldn't see who was doing it, but it sounded like this very large and very threatening group of guys. And I couldn't quite make out what they were saying, but it sounded something like, "Vargas!" And I didn't know what that meant, so I just kind of kept going about my day. And then they started calling and waking me up in the middle of the night, and they would scream, "Vargas!" it sounded like they were like above me and below me on the 18th and 20th floor windows, and they would scream it out into the darkness at night. And then they started leaving me messages on my answering machine with some voice modulator. It was like, Vargas, Vargas, Vargas. And I was starting to actually get a little nervous. And then it just kept getting worse. Like, they would whisper behind me in class. They'd be like, Vargas. And they'd yell at me in the dining hall. And it somehow word spread, and guys in the dorm next to mine started doing it too. And it was like everywhere I went, I heard this, and I didn't know what Vargas meant. So one day I'm at block party, and it's like the entire campus has descended on Fraternity Row. It's like 16, 20,000 students are there. And I'm hanging out, and I'm singing to the band, and I'm drinking like a Peach Bartles and James wine cooler. I'm having a good time. And then out of nowhere, 20 of these guys come up and surround me. And they're chanting, Vargas, Vargas, Vargas. And they're closing in on me. And the closer and closer they get to me, the farther away I see my friends walking. And my heart is racing. And finally, like, the big ringleader of the group is standing like right in front of me. And he kind of looks like a brawny Evander Holyfield. And he was this big football player on campus. And I finally, I guess it was like liquid courage from my wine cooler. And I was like, what does Vargas mean? And he got so close to my face, I could smell the cheap beer on his breath. And he goes, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you look like Mr. Vargas. And he starts laughing, and then they start laughing, and it's like building, and it's maniacal, and they're so close to me at this point. And I go, who's that? Now, if you guys don't know, Mr. Vargas was the science teacher in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He was played by this character actor named Vincent Schiavelli, who was also in this movie Ghost, where he played this crazy guy on this train where he had this like wild, crazy hair, and he was on the subway, and he's like, off my train! Get off my train! That's who they thought I looked like. And it wasn't just that that man is highly unattractive. It was that it was a man. And I was so crushed. I was so embarrassed and ashamed by that. But I didn't let on to my friends that that was how I felt. I just kept going as though everything was fine. But deep down, I was afraid to be home. I was afraid to be out. I was afraid to be anywhere. But I just kept going about my business. And a few weeks later, I'm on my way to class and I get on the elevator. I'm by myself and it stops on the 18th floor. The doors open and Chris is standing there with his friends. And his face lights up, and he smiles at me, and he gets on, and I don't say anything, and they don't say anything. I just stand there, and I stay fixated on the numbers, but I can feel their bulky winter coats rubbing up against me. And then we stop on 12, and more of them get on. And they're all smiling and smirking. Nobody's saying anything, but out of the corner of my eye, I see Chris go, and as he does that, his breath blows my curls across my face. But I just stay there and I keep watching those numbers. And then we stop on 5 and more of them get on. And at this point, the elevator is packed. Nobody can move. My heart is pounding out of my chest and I am freaking out because I don't know what to do because I'm afraid of what they're gonna do. And I finally stick my hand through their bodies and I hit the button for the 3rd floor. And as soon as the elevator's doors open, I race through them and I cross over and I hear them scream, Vargas, Vargas, Vargas. And I run through the common area and I hide inside the stairwell. And after that, I was like, I have to tell somebody. So I go and I tell the residence director. As soon as I went into her office, I was like, Susan, this is, you know, what's been going on. And she's like, ugh. She goes, Robin, I get complaints about these guys every single day. They're either beating people up or breaking into cars. You should consider yourself lucky. And I was like, that's not really the word that came to mind. But then I thought, well, maybe she's right. Like, maybe, relatively speaking, I am lucky. And maybe I should have told somebody sooner. Maybe I should have told my parents. And, you know, why didn't I do anything about this sooner? I was starting to get really angry. with myself. And so I was telling my friend Lisa about it. She's from Long Island. And she's like, are you fucking kidding me? You're being harassed. You need to talk to somebody. And I was like, okay, I'll do it. All right, you got it. So finally, I decided to go to the judicial board, which was so scary for me. But I went and I told them what was happening. And luckily, they took it seriously. They issued what they thought was a very appropriate punishment. They had them write letters of apology. And you can imagine like what these letters were. It's like, dear Robin, sorry I called you Vargas. Have a great summer. And at this point, actually, it had grown to like 60 guys who were involved in this. And the judicial board just punished 5 of them. But I was like, I don't care. I just want this to be behind me because I'm here to be in the Newhouse School. So a couple weeks later, I am getting all packed up to go home. Mindy's not in the room. I've got my door cracked open. I'm like rolling up my Howard Jones poster. I'm singing to Erasure. I'm having a good time. And I look up, and standing in the doorway is Chris. And I notice 2 things about him immediately. 1, he's alone. And 2, he's completely like hunched over, and he's staring at the floor. And I go, hi, Chris. And he reaches his hand out, and he's got this slip of paper in it, and he says, they told me I had to give you this. And I said, I know. Come on in. And the reason I wasn't nervous was because, A, because he was alone, but B, I've been taking classes in nonviolent action and social change all year. And I was like totally into like Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And I was like, this is like the perfect time to put this into practice. Like, love thy enemy. This is going to be amazing. So I have him sit down on my twin bed, my little pink comforter. He has a big football player. And I wheel my desk chair over to him. And I'm like 3 feet from his face because I want him to feel as scared of me as I've been of him. And I reach out my hand. I said, hi, I'm Robin. And he doesn't look up, but he shakes my hand back, and he goes, I'm Chris. I said, I know who you are. I said, you and your friends have made my life a living hell. I can't go anywhere without hearing this name. I just tried out to be the orange mascot, and you guys screamed at me the entire walk to the Carrier Dome and the entire time back. And I don't understand. We just met, right? And he's still not looking at me, but he's like, he's clearly very nervous. And I said, Chris, I just want to know one thing. Why? And he doesn't say anything. So I wheel my chair a little closer. I said, I just want to know why. And he doesn't say anything. So I let him go. Now, I wish I could tell you when I went back to sophomore year that everything changed and I got a clean slate. But the truth is that even though the yelling subsided, the stares and whispers and laughter continued. But I sucked it up because I was determined to not let them stop me from getting into the Newhouse program, and I got in. But it didn't matter because the damage was done. For the next 3 years, I did everything I could to avoid them. It was like I was constantly looking over my shoulder. So I took 21 credits like each semester. I would get up really early in the morning and I would come home very late at night to avoid them. I got involved in all kinds of activities where I knew they couldn't find me, like student government and dance troupe. I even joined the chapel choir, and I'm not even Christian. But the one thing that I wanted to do, and the whole reason I was there, was I wanted to join the campus TV and radio station, but I didn't do it. Because I was so afraid it was going to draw more attention to myself. And by the end of my senior year, I realized that I had been living in this like self-imposed witness protection program. And I graduated and I got my degree from the Newhouse School, and I was very, very happy. And at graduation, they had me sing the national anthem and the alma mater. And after that was done, I sang a funny song that I had written for the students. And I sang that song by myself, a cappella, in the Carrier Dome. And as I stood on this podium, I was so overwhelmed by this eruption of laughter from more than like 30,000 people who were laughing with me. And as I took that in, I looked down at those bullies. And for the first time, I felt so confident because I knew I was no longer afraid of them. But more than anything, I was no longer afraid to be myself. Thank you.
This is Risk, and I am still Cindy Freeman. That is my name. This is the Ting Tings behind me, and we have just heard from Robin Gelfenbein. God, I love that she just sat with him at the end of that story in her dorm room, and I'm just wondering, like, how does he remember and tell that story? Like,
there's this really great girl. She was in my college. I was this big jerk. And
anyway, this is not the only story that Robin has to tell. And to find out more about her and what she is up to, you can check her out at robingelfenbein.com. That is RobinGelfenbein.com. And that is it for the Best of Women's Stories episode. But of course, there are plenty of other amazing stories by women on the podcast to listen to. And I gotta say, if you are a woman and you have a great story about being a woman, please pitch it to us. Maybe you can be on the next Best of Women's Stories episode. Everything you need to know about how to pitch a story to us can be found on risk-show.com/submissions. I have been Cindy Freeman, and if you haven't gotten the impression yet, I have the best job in the world. I listen to amazing stories all day long, not just here, but also there's Risk and the Story Studio. And at the Story Studio, if you are interested on how to tell stories, we got you covered, whether you want to tell a story on stage, be the kind of person who can give the perfect wedding speech, or tell a story in business and do all sorts of creative things around business storytelling. You can reach out to me at cindy@thestorystudio.org. That is cindy@thestorystudio.org. And you can also look me up on my own website, which is Cindy Freeman Storyteller, cindyfreemanstoryteller.com. But most important, folks, today is the day. Take a risk.